Okay, we'll tell you the second story from Helm to get this hour started. In the Jewish homes, as Friday evening begins to set in, and the Sabbath will start once 3 stars are visible in the sky, there's a small ceremony conducted by the family. And families, especially rabbinic families, always had a very nice Sabbath cup from which they would drink the Sabbath wine from. And sometimes this cup has been passed down from generation to generation. And Rabbi Helm had a very beautiful Sabbath cup. He got it from his father, who got it from his father, and so on for a long line. They cannot think that far back. And now it was the turn of the firstborn son to receive this cup. So the father sits his son down and says, "Son, you will now inherit our Sabbath cup. From now on, you can drink your Sabbath wine from this cup as you see me do all your life. However, after 1 year about this cup, only drink from this side, never drink from this side of the cup." And the son says, "Well, I'm honored to receive it. I know what it means to the family, but I don't understand. Why should it matter what they drink from this side or this side?" Rabbi says, "Son, you have to listen to me. I am a very wise man. Only drink from this side of the cup. Because if you drink from this side of the cup, the wine will spill all over you." You like that one? Now you would think that he's got all of his armies in the Jezreel Valley, and he's been formed by those messengers we just read about before the hour ended, that his enemies have destroyed his capital. He wants to go back east to destroy his enemies. But it's not so much the Antichrist who is in control here, but Satan is, and Satan's goal is to save himself, not to save the Antichrist. And to save himself, he must destroy the Jews. So instead of moving east, the armies would begin to move south to attack the city of Jerusalem. Now, Zechariah chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3, and followed up by chapter 14, verse 1 and 2. He points out all the nations of the world would be gathered together against it. So all the armies of all the nations come together to attack Jerusalem. So the Antichrist will not go east to Babylon to destroy his enemies, but to go south, because Satan wants to carry out his program of Jewish destruction. Now, when the attack will be followed by some bitter fighting, as is described in one passage, Malachi chapter 4, verse 9 through chapter 5, verse 1. So verse 11, the nations assemble against Jerusalem. In verse 12, they become like sheaves on the threshing floor, because God's going to energize the Jewish forces so the weak ones among the Jews will fight like David did, and the Davids among the Jews will fight like the angel of Jehovah. But because of superiority in number, eventually Jerusalem does fall, and the words of Micah 5:1, the judge of Israel will be smitten with the rod upon his cheek, an ancient symbol of defeat and surrender. A second passage is Zechariah chapter 12, verses 4 through 9, and the judgment upon the horses and riders in verse 4, but again in verse 5 and 6, God will energize the Jews of Judah. And then Judah will cause tremendous decimation in the ranks of the enemy. In verse 7 and verse 8. But ultimately, this will lead to the judgment of the Gentiles. But it's this event that will finally cause Israel to turn to the Lord. There's two main ways to get to Jerusalem from the Jezreel Valley. One is the longer but more easier coastal route. The second is a shorter but a bit more treacherous central mountain route. The Bible does not specify which way he will go. So he may take one way or the other way. Also, he may do what Sennacherib does in Isaiah chapter 10. The Assyrian forces met in the valley of Jezreel, and then they were split in two, sending one half one way, one half the other in the days of King Hezekiah. Regardless of how they get there, Zechariah makes it clear in two of his passages they do get there. Jerusalem is attacked, and after some bitter fighting, Jerusalem does fall, and once again the city is trodden down by Gentile armies. Would you turn out the lights again, please? We'll first look at the old city, which has been part of Israel since 1967, and the new city, part of Israel, since 1948. And here you can see, for example, the old city from the top of Mount Scopus area. Here's a more traditional view from the top of the Mount of Olives. So I'm standing on the Mount of Olives, and here is the temple compound area where the third temple will eventually be built. Now, from the east wall of Jerusalem, which is right here, going down into valley and then up again to the top of Mount of Olives, is all nothing but tombs. Nothing but tombs. But three different kinds of tombs. The tombs against the wall are Muslim tombs. The tombs inside the valley are Christian tombs, by Christian using the larger term, meaning Catholic and Greek Orthodox. But from the bottom all the way to the top, these are all Jewish tombs. So you have Muslim tombs, Christian tombs, Jewish tombs, but the Jewish tombs have something that the Muslim tombs don't have and the Christian tombs don't have. Inside every Jewish tomb, there is a light inside, an Israelite. This is the southeast corner of the temple compound wall, the highest point from top to bottom, and the three temptations of Satan against Jesus took place on that point. Much of the wall you see today does not date back to biblical times. Most of the present-day wall was built by the Turks sometime after 1517 AD. And it was built by one Turkish sultan who humbly called himself Suleiman the Magnificent. Here you see the wall from the Garden of Gethsemane area. Here you look at the rooftops of the old city. On the horizon, here is Mount Scopus and the Hebrew University, and here is the Mount of Olives on this side. This is called the Western Wall by the Jewish people, the Wailing Wall by different groups of Gentiles who began calling it that. And this is the Western compound wall, outer wall of the temple compound. And because there's no temple standing here at the moment, this is not the holiest site of in Judaism. And the largest stones from about down in here and goes down to about 20 levels below the ground, these date back from the first century. The smaller stones you see up here and up here, these are mostly Crusader walls, bold stones. Up here are later Arab walls. The larger walls in the lower level and with 20, 21 levels below, it is made of those original stones of Herod the Great used. And this is the temple compound area. And the view of most archaeologists, historians, the Jewish temple, at least the second Jewish temple, stood over here where you have the Dome of the Rock. There's a minority view that stood 330 feet, and this would be this section here where they believe the Holy of Holies was. Neither one can prove their view because they cannot dig under temple compound because it is under Islamic control. But either more likely here and possibly here is where the temple once stood. Now go to the new city, which has been part of Israel since 1948, a very well-kept city comprised often modern Israeli condominiums, apartments. But you always have a mixture of the new and the old, and in this little valley, you have a monastery that was built in the 6th century AD. They call it the Monastery of the Cross. It's called the Monastery of the Cross because 6 centuries after the fact, it was built on the exact site where the tree grew, which the cross of Jesus was made. Now, if you believe that one, they'll tell you another one. It's a clean city, well-kept city. A very expensive city to live in today, and it'd be very difficult to find any decent housing on the Jewish side for less than $750,000 or more. But these are rather very expensive, cost you between $2 and $3 million to live one of these sections. This building on the left is the seat of the two chief rabbis of Israel, functions a bit like a Jewish Vatican. But this synagogue is the great synagogue of Jerusalem. Every Jewish city had many synagogues, like Tel Aviv and others, but every city has its own great synagogue, and this is the great synagogue of Jerusalem at this present time. And this is the Knesset building, the seat of the government. This is where the government meets and debates and makes their decision. So I covered the first three stages: the gathering at Armageddon, the attack on Jerusalem, destruction of Babylon, and the attack on Jerusalem. Now we need to deviate a bit to tie some loose ends together. What we've seen previously is that most of the Jewish people in Israel are no longer in the land. They have fled. And according to Matthew 24, they flee to the mountains. And according to Revelation 12, verse 6, they flee into desert territory outside the land and to a pre-existing city. So the clues we have so far to locate the city is Matthew 24, 16 in the mountains, Revelation 12, 6 in the wilderness, a place prepared in advance in chapter 12, verse 14, and a very defensible city. Isaiah chapter 33, verse 16. But the actual place that is given to us in the book of Micah chapter 2, verse 12, where the remnant of Israel is hiding, is a city known in Hebrew as Bozra, but today it's better known by its Greek name as Petra. And the Hebrew name is because of the nature of the city. Bozra means sheepfold. An ancient sheepfold had a narrow passageway going in, so the shepherd could count the sheep, but once the sheep were in the sheepfold, there's a larger area to wander around. And Bozra is shaped like a gigantic sheepfold, a narrow passageway going in, and then a lot of open area for the purpose of being able to maneuver. So it's very easily defended. And this is going to be the city of refuge for the Jewish people fleeing the land from the midpoint of the tribulation. Now as to why this place? The answer is given in Daniel chapter 11, verses 36 to 45. 11, 36 to 45 describes the Second World War that will occur in the middle of the tribulation. Antichrist will declare war against the 10 kings. And verse 41 specifies he will also take over the land of Israel, and we already saw that in Revelation 11. It also points out three countries escape his domination: Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And all three of these ancient nations comprise only one nation today, and that is the nation of the Jordan. There's a certain principle you find throughout Jewish history, and that one part of the world turns against the Jewish people, God always opens up another part of the world for the Jews to flee to. And so in the tribulation, when the whole world turns against the Jews, God also leaves this one area for the Jews to flee to. And so Jordan will be outside the political domination of the Antichrist. One of the more important years in Jewish history is the year 1492. That was the year that beginning with Spain. One European country after another began to expel the Jews from their borders. It's no accident that was the same year Columbus discovered the New World, which very quickly became a haven for Jewish refugees fleeing persecution. In the tribulation, the whole world under the Antichrist will turn against the Jews. And so as a result, God still leaves the one area open for the Jews to flee to, and that'll be the ancient territory of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And the city of Bozrah is in the territory of Edom, which is now southern Jordan. And so from the midpoint of tribulation onward, the Jews are fleeing to the city of Bozrah, now known as Petra. I'll have several views of this. For it to be the correct location, it has to meet the three requirements we mentioned. First of all, it must be in desert territory. And this is all desert territory, as you see all over here. Secondly, it must also be in the mountains. You see the jagged mountains of a range of mountains called Mount Seir in the Bible, S-C-I-R, S-C-I-R, Mount Seir. And the city is located within these mountains. And these first two shots were still outside the city. And we're still outside the city here. And here is the beginning of the passageway, the wadi, that begins right here. You have to walk the length of it about a mile and a quarter before you finally get into the city. And as you keep walking down the passageway, the wadi gets narrower, and the walls on both sides get a lot higher. And here's an example about the halfway point. This is the passageway. Notice how narrow the passageway has become. And this gives you a sense of proportion. You see horses and people below. And since you're from Texas, you can tell the difference. And notice on both sides how high the mountains up, and I haven't reached with my camera to the top of it. But as you pass through it, you'll consistently go through this passageway. This is the other end of the passageway, about to enter the city, and now we are inside the city, and here's the narrow passageway from inside the city. Now, two different groups inhabited the city. First were the Nabataeans, followed by the Romans, and both have left their remains. But even if you never had one day in archaeology, merely by looking, you can tell the difference between Nabataean and Roman remains, because the Romans built like everyone else built, rock upon rock, stone upon stone. Nabataeans did not like to do it that way. They would go to the edge of a cliff like this one and this one and simply chisel out one building from it, and here is just one of many examples. This whole building is just one piece of rock. How big is it? There's an Arab man with his keffiyeh sitting right here. Notice, look how small he is. Gives you a sense of proportion. And that's where the Greek named the city Petra. Petra means cliff rock, and this is a city that has buildings that were carved out of the cliff rock. Once you're inside this, it opens up into a large circular area that illustrates the meaning of Bozrah, a narrow passageway going in, and then a wider circular area for the sheep to maneuver. And this is like a giant Bozrah, a giant sheepfold. There's lots of room for growing food, lots of places to stay in, but nobody lives in the city today. It's waiting to become a future Jewish neighborhood. Here you see an example of the Nabataean version of a condominium up here. A closer view of the condominium. Again, notice the Arab man with the keffiyeh right here. Look how small he is compared to this whole structure. Now, these large buildings were more for the wealthy class. The poorer people had to live in these houses, like almost tenement houses. But notice they're also carved from the sides of the cliff. So everywhere you go as you travel, to see the whole, every little angle, you have to stay there for about 3 to 5 days to see everything. Most Jews, you'll see a few high points. But you'll be confronted by these buildings. Here again, this whole building is just one piece of rock. Here is a man sitting at the doorway. Look how small he is. Often made of soft sandstone, so you see this multicolored area. Otherwise, it's surrounded by these massive cliff rocks. Only way of going in and going out is that one way. This is the main street during its Nabataean control, during its Roman era. You can tell that from the rock, stone upon stone, that lined the pillars, stone upon stone at the main gate. And while the road itself is Nabataean, it dead ends at the Nabataean remains against the cliff. This Roman amphitheater that will comfortably seat 3,000 people. I can visualize the elders meeting here to discover why these things have fallen and what they need to do about it. This is the Roman administration building during its Roman period. And this is where the governor of the city would operate, also served as a temple where they would come to. So this is said to be the city of refuge during the tribulation. This would bring out the fourth stage, because the bulk of the remnant surviving the tribulation is located in this particular city. Now, as we mentioned yesterday, the abomination of desolation will inaugurate the final attempt to destroy the Jews. According to Zechariah chapter 13, verse 8 and 9, Zechariah 13, 8 and 9, two-thirds of the Jewish population will be killed, but one-third survives. A majority of the one-third that survives is in the city. And since the Jews are targeted, in the fourth stage, the armies will move against the Jews of Bozra, Jeremiah 49, verses 13 and 14. The nations of Europe gather at Bozra, and the focus is to destroy the remnant of Israel being gathered there. And so the map, the Himnah moves from Jerusalem all the way down to the city of Bozra and Petra. That will bring on the fifth stage of the national regeneration of Israel. The Jewish leaders in Petra, Bozra will finally discover why all these things have occurred, and they realize now what they must do about it. As I mentioned, they must do two things yesterday. First of all, there's the national confession of Israel, of their sin of rejecting the Messiah on the grounds of being demonized. But secondly, they must plead for him to return, to mourn for him as one mourns for only son. This is the precondition to the second coming. So before Leviticus 26, these are verses we looked at yesterday, that there must be one specific sin that must be confessed before they have all of the promised land, before the Messianic kingdom could be established. And so Zechariah 13 describes the national cleansing of Israel. Zechariah 14 describes the second coming and kingdom. As we saw, both are conditioned by Zechariah 12, verse 10, they shall look unto the one whom they have previously pierced. And in Matthew 23, verses 37 through 39, he pointed out a passage we looked at yesterday, that just as the Jewish leaders once led the nation to reject him, a day must come and they will lead the nation to accept him. And the key verse says Hosea chapter 5, verse 15. God is speaking. God says he's now going to return to his place. His place is heaven. And to return to heaven, he had to leave it, which he did at the incarnation. And then because of the offense committed against him, he returned to heaven at his ascension on Mount of Olives. And he will not come back until the offense is confessed. Now, a passage we have not looked at is this passage here, Hosea chapter 6, verses 1, 2, and 3. And Hosea chapter 6, verses 1, 2, and 3 follows up from chapter 5, verse 15. It meets the condition of Hosea 5, 15. And in verses 1 and 2, the leadership of Israel is going to issue the decree to call upon national repentance, a national change of mind, that this Jesus really was the Messiah. And for the first two of the last 3 days, they will confess their national sin. And the words that they will be using when they confess is recorded in Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. So Isaiah 53 is not only a prophecy of Messiah's death and resurrection, it's more than that. As you read the first 9 verses, this is Israel confessing their failure to recognize him when he first came. They thought he was suffering for his own sins, and now they realize he was suffering for their sins. So this will be the words of Israel's confession. Then on the third day, the whole nation will come to faith. And the whole nation will be emphasized, Hosea 6, verse 3, the whole nation will come to faith. Isaiah 66, verse 8, Isaiah 66, verse 8, they'll be born in one day. Zechariah chapter 3, verse 9, Zechariah 3, verse 9, God removed the iniquity of the land in one day. And the all Israel shall be saved is a quotation from Paul's Epistle of Romans, chapter 11, verse 26, 11, 26. And now they fulfill the second part of the precondition to plead for Messiah's return. In this manner, the physical blessings will be restored because they return to the Lord spiritually. Now, the words of the pleading are found in Isaiah 64, verses 1 through 12. And in verse 1 and 2, they plead for the Lord to come down. There's God in verses 3 through 7 to remember his previous mighty works on behalf of Israel. And now in verse 8, they seek those mighty works again to be rescued from the endangerment of the surrounding Gentile armies. And in verse 9, they'll ask for the forgiveness of their sin. Jerusalem has been made a desolation by the nations when the armies attacked Jerusalem. The temple was now defiled in verse 11 since the middle of tribulation. And therefore in verse 12, they make a plea to God to intervene lest they too become ruined. You have two psalms which are the parochial version of Israel's pleading for God to rescue them from a specific predicament. So verses 1 through 4, they recall of events that happened in Jerusalem and what the Gentiles have done to Jerusalem. In verses 5 through 7, there's a plea for God to come down to rescue them. They also plea for the forgiveness of the sins in verses 8 and 9. And in verses 10 through 12, they ask for revenge, and asking God to save them from their enemies. And anticipation in verses 13 and 14 to give thanks and sing praises to God. Another example is Psalm 80, verses 1 through 19. In verse 1, they plead for the shepherd of Israel to come and save them from a specific predicament, and also plead in verses 2 and 3 for their spiritual salvation. In verses 4 through 7, they are again pleading for being rescued physically. And in verses 8 through 11, they recall God's past dealing with Israel, how he frequently saved them previously from physical destruction, and now they're asking him to save them once again. So verses 12 and 13, there is a mourning for their present state. Verses 14 through 16, they appeal to God to defend the cause of Israel. But verse 7 is very specific. They're addressing their prayer to God, but notice what they're asking for. And verse 17 says, let your hand be upon the man of your right hand, upon the Son of Man, who you may strong for yourself. The one they're asking for specifically in verse 17 is the one at the right hand of God the Father. And they refer to him as the Son of Man, which was a messianic title. And so they're sincerely asking for the one that is now seated at the right hand of God, the Son of Man. And they call upon him of the Lord in verse 18 and 19, which guarantees their spiritual salvation. As a result of spiritual salvation, he will return on their behalf. Now we have the sixth stage, which is the second coming of the Messiah. Initial place of the second coming is going to be the city of Bostra or Petra. That's where he comes to first. This may be a new thought for you, so let's go ahead and look at some passages. Let's turn the lights back on. And I may have it here. Okay. I'll give you two passages we won't take time to look at, and I'll give you two passages that I'll be looking at. The first passage you can mark down is Micah chapter 2, verse 12 and 13. Micah 2, verse 12 and 13. Also Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 3, Habakkuk 3:3. Now verse 1 says, "Come near, you nations, to hear, and hearken, ye peoples, let the earth hear, and the fullness thereof, and the world, and all things that come forth from it. For Jehovah had indignation against all the nations, and wrath against all their armies. He'll destroy them, he led them to the slaughter. Their slain also shall be cast out, and the stench of dead bodies shall come up, and the mountain shall be melted with the blood." And so far, notice what he has said. God has wrath and indignation against all the nations, but specifically against all the armies of all the nations. And the sword of the Lord is about to strike all the armies of all the nations. And so just before the sword strikes, in verse 4, the convulsions on earth, shakings in the heaven. And then verse 5 tells us the country where the sword of God strikes against all the armies of all the nations. And that sword strikes in the land of Edom, southern Jordan. So he strikes all the armies, but they're located in the land of Edom. And then verse 6 and 7 gets even more specific. Specifically, he points out the sword will fall upon Bozrah, which is where the armies have gathered together within the land of Edom of southern Jordan. Now, a bit more descriptive and graphic is our next passage, so let's go ahead and turn to Isaiah 63. In this passage of Isaiah 63, 1 through 6, the prophet is in a vision, standing along the mountain ranges of Israel, looking towards the southeast, and suddenly sees a graphic and glorified figure approaching him. And so there's a question-answer session ensues between the prophet and this individual. So two questions are asked and two questions are answered. The first question is in verse 1, "Who is this that comes from Edom, with dyed garments from Bozrah, this whose glory is in the peril, marching in the greatness of his strength?" And the answer is, "I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save." Only one person can truly fit this description, who walks in the greatness of his power, whose very clothing has been glorified by the Shekinah glory itself. Only one person can make the statement this one makes, and that to speak in righteousness, with full ability to save, and that's none other than the Messiah himself. Now coming to Israel, but notice where he's coming to Israel from. The land is Edom, or southern Jordan, and the city is Bozrah, or Petra. Now when the figure draws closer to the prophet, he notices something else. Although the clothing has been glorified by the Shekinah glory, it has been stained with blood. And now we'll now raise the second question in verse 2. "Wherefore are you red in your apparel, and your garments like him that treadeth the wine vat?" And then comes the answer in verse 3. "I have trodden the winepress alone, of the peoples there was no man with me. Yea, I trod them down in mine anger and trampled them in my wrath. The lifeblood is sprinkled upon my garments that have stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. And I looked, and there was none to help, and thy wonders are none to uphold. Therefore mine own arm brought salvation unto me, and my wrath that upheld me. And I trod down the peoples in mine anger, and made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth." The reason his clothing has become bloodstained is because he's coming from a tremendous conflict. In this conflict, he had to trample the enemy. In the course of trampling the enemy, their lifeblood spilled over and stained his garments. But where did the fighting occur? Context: in the land of Edom or southern Jordan, or the city of Bostra Petra. Also notice that when he enters into conflict with the armies of the Antichrist, he will do so all by himself. Now the angelic army come back with him at the second coming, and we church saints come back with him at the second coming, but notice neither we nor the angels participate in the fighting. So if any of you have been practicing maneuvers for this last war, you may as well skip it. He won't need our help after all. But that is the initial place of the second coming. I gave you Habakkuk 3, verse 3. God comes from Teman and Mount Paran, both in the vicinity of Bostra. Micah 2, 12 and 13, the remnant of Israel will be gathered in Bostra. After the siege, they'll be led by Jehovah the King. Judges 5, verse 4 and 5, God has seen us coming from Mount Seir and the land of Edom coming to Israel. This will bring on the seventh stage, the battle from Bostra to the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And the battle will begin, this is Joel 3, verses 12 and 13, the battle will begin at Bostra and make its way all the way back to just outside of Jerusalem in the Valley of Jehoshaphat that separates the city from the Mount of Olives. And the winepress mentioned in Joel is also the winepress of Revelation 14, 17 to 20, where the blood level reaches the height of a horse's neck. And the 200 miles extend from Jerusalem to the Gulf of Aqaba. That's where the city of Eilat is located at this point of time. There's the map on it. It goes all the way back to the valley, to Jerusalem, and ends in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Valley of Jehoshaphat starts out rather wide. Can you turn the lights again, please? The Valley of Jehoshaphat is over here. Here's the old city. Here's the Mount of Olives, and it flows between the two mounts. The starts out rather wide and lush green, but as you keep moving south, it will get narrow, and it will get considerably drier. This is the bottom of the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where you have the Christianized graves. And you can see the dryness of it here, except for the trees planted by the Israeli authorities. It narrows down to this small wadi and continues to flow all the way to the Dead Sea. If you try to visualize the blood level of the horse's neck in the Valley of Jezreel, that would be difficult and has very good draining system, but the Bible puts it here, not in Jezreel. Puts it right here. You notice how narrow this valley is. It may not be all that difficult to visualize. And that will lead to the eighth and final stage, which is the victory ascent up upon the Mount of Olives. And Zechariah 14 points out that his feet will in that day stand. It doesn't say he descends upon the Mount of Olives, by the way. It simply says his feet shall in that day stand upon the Mount of Olives in verse 4. But notice the timing of it in Zechariah 14. In verses 1 and 2, all the armies of nations come against Jerusalem. Verse 3 says, Jehovah will go forth and fight against all those nations that gathered against Jerusalem. It's only when the fighting is over does he now stand upon the Mount of Olives. As a result, the Mount of Olives will split into two parts, creating a valley running east and west. And because when he stands upon the Mount of Olives, there is an earthquake further destroying what was already not destroyed in Jerusalem. And this earthquake will cause the Mount of Olives to split, and the Jews in Jerusalem will be able to flee through this new valley, flee the earthquake, and escape being harmed by the earthquake. There's one segment that's something not on the screen. Turn your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12. Notice what he says in verse 7. Jehovah also shall save the tents of Judah first. The glory of the house of David, the glory of the house of Jerusalem, shall not be magnified above Judah. Notice that before he comes to rescue Jerusalem, he will save the tents of Judah first. The fact that Jews living in tents tells you not living at homes, they're living in tents somewhere else, and what they are, as we saw from Micah and elsewhere, is the city of Bozrah or Petra. And God will first rescue the Jews living in Bozrah or Petra, the tents of Judah first, before he rescues the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And that's why the chronological sequence is the way we've been designing the map for. Okay, put the lights out again one more time. So now he will with the fighting over in Jehoshaphat, he now ascend to the Mount of Olives, which will mark the end of tribulation and the end of the campaign of Armageddon. What's called the Mount of Olives is actually three mounts, with the central mount being the more dominant, also somewhat clouded with churches nowadays. For example, this church here is a Catholic church. It's called the Church of All Nations. It marks a spot in the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus led most of his disciples to guard the gate. Go about halfway up, you'll see a Russian Orthodox church. And that marks a spot where Jesus prayed. And this little chapel is where Jesus lamented over Jerusalem. Now, they have their own names for these churches. Over the years, I've given them my own names. And this is the official name for this church, is the Church of Mary Magdalene. I call it the Church of the Onion Heads, for those reasons on top. The most dominant church is also Russian Orthodox Church, right on top of the mountain right here with this large tower. It's called the Church of the Ascension. And it marks the exact spot from which he ascended. And if you go inside, they show you a slab of stone with these two footprints embedded into it. Because when the Messiah blasted off, he burned these footprints into the rock. But here again, they picked the wrong spot. Because the Luke chapter 24 specifies that he was ascending from the Mount of Olives when he was by the town of Bethany, which is on the lower eastern slope somewhere over here. So they missed this one by about a mile and a half. Not as bad as the 45-mile problem. Here's another view of the Church of the Onion Heads. Coming in my direction, they also built a church in the exact spot where the rooster crowed when Peter denied Jesus three times. The official name is the Church of Peter of Gallicunta. I call it the Church of the Cock-a-Doodle-Doo. Here is the temple compound. This is the Mount of Olives over here, the temple compound area. For years, I've been doing these special 5-week-long trips of Israel. I did my last one last May and June. And because of my wife's condition, I won't be doing those anymore. Whenever I brought them to the Sea of Galilee, I always praised the Lord for making the Sea of Galilee so big so they could not build a church over. Because if they could have, they would have. All right, here's your summary of all 8 stages. First stage is the assembling of the allies of the Antichrist. That's when the army leaves Babylon and goes to the northern part of Israel, the Jezreel Valley. Second stage will be the destruction of Babylon. Stage 3 will be the attack and the fall of Jerusalem. Stage 4, the armies of the Antichrist come against the Jews of Bozrah and Petra. Stage 5 will be Israel's national salvation. Stage 6, the second coming at Bozrah. Stage 7, the war starts here and continues all the way back towards Jerusalem. and comes to an end in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. A stage is the victory ascent up upon the Mount of Olives. So these are the eight stages of the campaign of Armageddon. Now let's go back to your Revelation PowerPoint. And there's one more. We'll now look at the last part of chapter 16 before your break, and I'll complete the Armageddon study. So seven bowl judgment is in verses 17 through 21. And this is a part of the eight stages we just talked about. And so the seven bowl judgment brings to the tribulation to a definite end. And looking at verse 17, and the seven brothers bowl upon the earth, and there comes forth a great voice out of heaven from the throne saying, it is finished. So what was said about the trumpet judgment, the seven trumpet judgment in chapter 10 and chapter 11, they will complete the wrath of God. And now with the seven bowl judgment, it is finished. And this is the eighth stage of the campaign of Armageddon. And verse 8 and verse 19, there'll be convulsions of nations and a great earthquake, causing the city of Jerusalem to be divided into three different parts. And that's why there'll be a total supernatural rebuilding of the city in preparation for the Messianic kingdom. And the city of Babylon will suffer the wrath of God, which he will detail in chapter 18. In verse 20, there'll be major geographical changes. Some things remain the same, some things will be quite different. And hail will fall. Each hailstone will be 120 pounds. And that'll give you an acceptable headache, 666.